This is the first big bite of the apple, if you will, and it's pretty exciting just to at least have some details out there.
The federal government releases the permit application for the Pebble Mine. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, fishermen react to the Trump administration proposal to open nearly all waters off Alaska's coast to oil drilling.
You need to be careful up here, whatever you're doing. This is really, really dangerous waters. The fishermen know that, and everybody in the Arctic Rim knows that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
Now that the Trump administration removed a key roadblock, Pebble is chugging through the bureaucratic process needed to get approval to build its mine. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers today says the Pebble Limited Partnership's permit application is complete. It's a highly technical document with details on what the controversial mine in southwest Alaska could look like. But opponents remain unconvinced. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
In October, Pebble Limited Partnership released some details on how it plans to build a copper and gold mine near Iliamna. Then, the company claimed it was making a series of adjustments to make the mine safer. It promised a smaller mine than the company originally set out to build, for example. The application the Army Corps of Engineers released gives a fuller picture of Pebble's plans. It's also a pivotal step. Now, the federal environmental review process can begin. That will help agencies decide whether they should approve the mine. Mike Heatwall is a spokesman for the Pebble Limited Partnership.
This is the first big bite of the apple, if you will, and it's pretty exciting just to at least have some details out there that people can now start to take a look at and say, this is how the Pebble team proposes to design and operate a responsible plan for developing the mineral resources at Pebble.
The application includes maps of the open pit mine and the tailings storage facility. It shows roads the company wants to build to access the mine. The plan calls for a port on the west shore of Cook Inlet, an ice-breaking ferry across Lake Iliamna, and a natural gas pipeline from the Kenai Peninsula to help power the whole operation. Many details could be adjusted as Pebble continues its work with the government agencies that could approve the project. According to Pebble, the mine itself will have a footprint of nearly 11 square miles. The application states that over a period of 2 decades, the company aims to mine 1.2 billion tons of material. So far, none of the fine print is changing the minds of activists fighting the mine.
The short time we've had to review kind of the highlights of this permit application, it confirms every concern we have had for over the last decade.
That's Alana Hurley with United Tribes of Bristol Bay, one of the mine's most outspoken opponents. Hurley pushes back at Pebble's message that they're building a smaller mine than originally planned. She points out the application shows over 3,000 acres of wetlands and waters that must be filled in to build the mine site. But opponents' main message is that they're worried this plan is just a beginning.
I think this is a classic bait and switch.
Tim Bristol is executive director for Salmon State, another group against the project. Bristol is against the mine as it's proposed now, but he also says there's nothing stopping anyone from pursuing a bigger mine at a later date. But Bristol's worried this plan could get a green light from government agencies, especially under the Trump administration.
They're trying as hard as they can to get this thing into permitting now, and I don't think anyone can doubt the fact that it's going to be a much more permissive permitting process during this administration than during the last one.
Under the Obama administration, the Environmental Protection Agency proposed putting restrictions on the mine. But after President Donald Trump took office, EPA reached a settlement with Pebble, and the company began moving forward again. Pebble says if the company wanted to expand the mine in the future, they'd have to roll out a new proposal and get new approvals. Heatwall calls the immediate negative response to the permit application unfortunate.
To say unequivocally that that the mine presents risks that can't be managed is, I think, premature and prejudicial.
Pebble also recently announced it secured a new partner, the Canadian company First Quantum Minerals. That partnership will help fund the permitting process, although the companies haven't yet reached a final deal on funding the actual project. As the environmental review process moves forward, the Army Corps says it will hold a series of public meetings. The agency says final approval could take several years. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
For years, the debate over offshore drilling in Alaska has focused on the Arctic. But this week, the Trump administration proposed opening almost all Alaska waters to oil and gas leasing from southeast to the Bering Strait to the Canadian border. That includes areas that have never seen drilling. Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk reports on the reaction from coastal communities.
Ask Linda Benkin of Sitka how she feels about the proposal.
I probably better not say that on tape.
Benkin heads up the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association. She worries that an oil spill anywhere in the Gulf of Alaska or the Bering Sea could put fish stocks all over the state at risk.
It's really deeply disturbing to see the willingness to place at risk up and down our coasts the renewable resources that are the cornerstone of the economy and people's way of life.
That's a feeling echoed by Mark Vinsel. He runs the United Fishermen of Alaska, which represents the state's commercial fisheries. Vinsel says he's glad the Trump administration excluded the North Aleutian Basin planning area, which borders Bristol Bay. But he says fishermen haven't forgotten the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. And if more waters are opened up to oil and gas development, there needs to be a lot of community oversight. He says the message is pretty simple.
You need to be careful up here, whatever you're doing. This is really, really dangerous waters. The fishermen know that, and everybody in the Arctic Rim knows that.
In Unalaska, Mayor Frank Kelty was taken by surprise when he heard the Trump administration was proposing to open waters surrounding the Aleutians and Pribilofs. Kelty says he's not opposed to oil and gas development, but Unalaska depends on fishing, and any oil and gas drilling would have to be done right.
I think there's going to be a lot of pushback from not just the enviro community, but from coastal communities such as mine and other fishery-dependent communities across the country.
Across the country, because the Trump administration is also proposing to open waters up and down the east and west coasts, from Maine to Florida and Washington to California. The proposal also came as a surprise in Nome. Austin Amasek works for Kowarik, which represents tribes across the Bering Strait region. He says local communities have made it very clear where they stand. They've opposed oil and gas development in their waters for decades.
You know, there are areas where our people have hunted and commercially fished for quite a long time. It's where we make our living, so we're quite concerned about the aggressive nature of this draft proposed program.
The Trump administration has stressed that this is just a draft. The Interior Department could remove some areas from the final plan, depending on feedback from communities. The proposal will be open for public comment for the next 2 months. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Both Platinum and Quinnahock are applying for aid following a high-speed storm that ripped through the communities days before Christmas. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
The city of Quinnahock is surveying the extent of the damage.
We needed to know how many people got damages.
That's City Administrator Annie Roach. Damage includes smokehouses, sheds, and fish racks blown apart, porches wrenched from homes, windows cracked, and boats flipped, wrecking motors. Roach says residents have been streaming into the city office to share what happened to them, and both the Red Cross and the state have reached out to Quinnahock asking for this information. Roach plans to submit their findings in the coming days and hopes funding will follow. In the meantime, residents are working to repair what they can. The most pressing issue is roofing. Many homes are threatened by water damage after losing pieces of their roofs. Tin sheeting covers most houses, and the village store quickly sold out days after the storm. Store manager Warren Jones says only rolled roofing remains, and people are using a mixture of the rolls and tarps as a temporary fix.
So I'm just waiting on people to call me if they need tin and stuff so we can place an order through air freight.
Air delivery will jack up the price, but the other option is to wait for the spring barge. On Tuesday, the Quinnahock Native Corporation finished repairing what they could on the fuel pumps disabled during the storm, but a lineman has to fly from Anchorage to fix the pump's electric line. Until then, workers will continue to pump gasoline and stove oil manually. The rationing of both has ended. One of the biggest casualties from the storm was the fuel warehouse that toppled over with an employee inside. Fuel manager John Hunter says the building has been demolished and replaced with something he hopes won't blow away, a giant storage van.
We insulated inside the van and put a floor, ceiling, and making a desk for the gas man.
Surprisingly, a likely storm casualty was left unscathed. Natural Resource Director for the Native Village of Quinnahock, Stephen Jones, did not measure any erosion on the crumbling Quinnahock coastline. Even the village's famous archaeological site looks untouched. But the storm did alter the land, says Tribal Administrator Ferdinand Cleveland Jr.
We had snow before that storm, about 6 inches or more of snow. And after the storm, they all melted away.
Along with the river ice, that took away access to hunting, fishing, and trapping grounds. Further down the coast from Quinnahock, the village of Platinum also sustained minor damage and is reviewing aid applications. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, shedding light on ancient Beringians.
It opens the window for a much wider, more accurate perspective on the complex colonization of the New World.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
UAF archaeology professor Ben Potter and an international team of scientists he worked with has discovered evidence of a previously unknown ancient people who were among the first to cross over from Asia to Alaska more than 15,000 years ago. The scientists base their findings on analysis of DNA from two infants buried more than 11,000 years ago at a site south of Fairbanks. The research was published Wednesday in the journal Nature, and as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, it sheds new light on when and how the ancestors of today's indigenous peoples first settled the New World.
You know, we are humans. We are hunter-gatherers. Ellis, has been.
Ben Potter couldn't even get a cup of coffee Wednesday morning because he was fielding interviews with reporters from around the world who were clamoring to talk about the article that he and two fellow researchers had co-authored, a piece that had already created quite a stir in the scientific community.
The importance of the paper is, one, that we've identified a brand new population that we hitherto did not know existed, ancient Beringians. And the second is what the implications are for that, for understanding the people into the New World, which, you know, is pretty profound.
The article is the latest chapter in the evolving study of how humans migrated from Asia to North America and how some, but not all, went on to settle the rest of the Western Hemisphere.
It opens the window for a much wider, more accurate perspective on the complex colonization of the New World.
The key evidence that opened that window wide came from DNA samples taken from the remains of an infant girl who'd been buried more than 11,000 years ago at a site located on a ridge above the Tanana River about 50 miles south of Fairbanks. Archaeologists first found the remains of a young child at the so-called Upward Sun River site in 2010, and further excavation revealed those of two infants.
These two were part of an ancient population that came into the New World survived. We're part of a very well-adapted group of people that survived for thousands of years in the far north.
Potter says the genetic analysis and other evidence confirmed the infant whose genome was analyzed was descended from a group that had separated from other East Asian peoples about 35,000 years ago. But the data also showed the infant likely was not related to the people who crossed over from Asia and then migrated into both North and South America, the people who became Native Americans. So Potter and fellow researchers concluded the infant was descended from a new and heretofore unknown group they called ancient Beringians. The name refers to the region known as Beringia, which encompasses most of Alaska, eastern Siberia, and the land bridge that once connected the two continents and which is now submerged below the Bering Sea. Potter says the ancient people settled in Beringia for a few thousand years, despite the harsh ebb and flow of the Pleistocene Ice Age.
Throughout periods of almost unimaginable climate change, from full glacial conditions to essentially the modern boreal forest, with extinctions of mammoth, later on extinction of bison. So major climate, vegetation, and animal abundance changes, but yet they persisted throughout this region.
All of which, Potter says, leads one to wonder what happened to the ancient Beringians.
The answer is we don't know at this point.
Potter says, however, there's no question that the history of the New World's indigenous peoples grows more complex with every new study that's published. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Tonight, an art exhibit opens at Alaska Pacific University that draws together work from many disciplines. The show, Microbial Worlds, celebrates microscopic life. And as KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, it seeks to offer a bridge between the arts and sciences.
Microbial Worlds is just the latest collaborative venture for Mary Beth Lee. Lee received a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Creative Dance before going on to graduate school in the sciences, and she eventually became a microbiologist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Almost a decade ago, she co-founded a consortium project called In a Time of Change. It seeks to celebrate the arts and sciences as complementary avenues for exploring the dynamic nature of the world. But Lee concedes the current exhibit, the fifth in the series, offered some unique hurdles.
Microorganisms present a particular challenge because they're invisible, and you really just kind of have to believe what people tell you. And so I really wanted to help them become their own microbiologists.
Lee did that by offering short courses and labs, calling on 30 of her scientific colleagues to interact with the 14 artists and writers. Once a month for 16 months, the group gathered and visited research sites like Tulik Field Station and Bonanza Creek Experimental Forest. Lee says the process demanded time and commitment, so when she originally issued a call to artists, she hoped for more than talent.
One of the things we were looking for was people who had just a sincere curiosity about the natural world and an eagerness to learn more about how it works and to integrate that into their artwork.
The response generated expressions in fiber art, tiles, sculpture, painting, box construction, dance, and literature. Retired teacher and poet Susan Campbell produced an artist book as well as poems. At a reading associated with the show's premiere in Fairbanks last year, she spoke about the process.
Throughout the past year, every scientific presentation and lecture and field trip that we did, it just sent me off to find out more.
Campbell also read from her work. She says her poem, Make Yourself at Home, tries to capture the inescapable intimacy we unknowingly have with microbes.
This underbelly rich seam of life that coats it, moves through it on gusts of wind, currents of water, these mobile bags of flesh.
Microbial Worlds runs through January at Alaska Pacific University's art galleries. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Subsistence Board is accepting applications through February 2nd to fill seats on the 10 Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Councils meet at least twice a year and provide critical advice to the board on subsistence management issues. Individuals may apply or nominate someone for membership. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456. This message is sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, leaving. Alaska is a big place, but it doesn't have a lot of roads to show for it. It does have the Alaska Marine Highway System, though, which many people travel by ferry. Some use it to move to Alaska, and others when it's time to leave, including Alaska Public Media correspondent Vikram Patel. Last November, he left the state and sent us this report.
As I roam the decks of the MV Columbia, I wonder who these other passengers are. I figure some of them are like me. I've lived in Alaska for over a decade, but I'm moving away because my mom is sick and I want to be closer to her. But why is everyone else leaving? I started asking around.
Name is Grover Montano. I'm from San Diego, California. I'm 56 years old.
What are you doing on the ferry?
Going back home. Had to come over here and help a friend in Ketchikan.
Montano just spent 2 months in Ketchikan on behalf of the Chumash Indian tribe in California to request bear skins and eagle feathers for religious ceremonies from the local native community. Happily, Montana reported that his mission was a success, but by the time I found him, he was back in vacation mode, sleeping in a tent on the deck of the ferry and spending his days enjoying the view.
We're on the stern of the ship, surrounded by some beautiful islands covered in spruce, hemlock, and yellow cedar. Seas are calm, winds are fair, sun is shining, and it's in my hair.
Some of the other passengers on the ferry are also returning from short stints in Alaska. But not all of their missions were as successful as Montano's.
My name is Tyler Harrison Clark. I'm 33 years old, and I am in a third life crisis right now. I was living in Seattle February of this year. I was engaged to be married, and at that time I was cheated on. Our relationship ended. I was also working at sort of a dead-end job.
While piecing his life back together, Clark found himself in the Seattle airport talking to a woman who lived in Juneau.
We talked for 20 minutes. She went up to Alaska. I went back to California. Didn't exchange any information. The next day, I ended up finding her. Then we talked for about a month or so and decided that booking a trip to Alaska was like the next fun thing to do.
But Clark's romantic weekend didn't go quite as planned. It seems his new friend regretted the invitation.
I like to think in like numbers. I was there for 4 days, 96 hours. I probably collectively spent like 6 hours with her. And I was hoping for just a little bit more.
After spending 4 days wandering around Juneau, mostly by himself, it was time for Clark to leave Alaska.
And here I am on her suggestion on this ferry.
Do you think you'll see her again?
I do.
Unlike Montano, who slept outdoors in the deck, Clark set up his makeshift campsite indoors, in the back row of the movie theater on board. But most of the passengers sprung for a cabin, including Cami Heiser, a single mom who was on the ferry with her two young sons. They live in Kenny Lake, an Alaskan town of about 400 people near McCarthy, but wintertime in a cabin with two small kids in the middle of nowhere can be tough. So Heiser decided to get some backup.
We're going to do a road trip to go visit family in New Hampshire.
What's been the best part of the trip so far?
As a single parent traveling with two kids, it's pretty awesome that everyone loves my kids and wants to help out and hang out and play.
Heiser's 5-year-old son, Taj, has a more practical assessment.
What do you like about this boat?
That it floats on water.
Turns out that Taj is something of an ocean expert.
And I know, Taj, your favorite place in the ocean is the, what is it?
Mariana's Trench.
Nice. Which is?
The deepest place in the ocean.
What's in the Mariana Trench?
Animals that can survive in really deep pressure.
On the last night of the trip, about 30 people, both passengers and crew, put on a talent show. Montano played his guitar, Clark performed a magic trick, and Heiser sang a few songs. Anchorage musician Nick Carpenter is one of the passengers who suggested the impromptu talent show.
An older woman from Juneau brought tears to my eyes. Off the cuff, she hadn't practiced, didn't even have a guitar, had to borrow one. She played a cover of What a Wonderful World. And, I mean, I don't know if there was a dry eye in the house. You know, these lyrics, they were kind of mirroring how sweet this moment on the boat was.
A After 3 days, 4 nights, and 1 talent show, we arrived at the ferry terminal in Bellingham, Washington. Leaving the boat and Alaska, we all proceeded to our next stops. For AK, I'm Vikram Patel.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Frida Koper in Anchorage. Koper owns the Flying Dutchman Pastry Shop, a family business that's been around for 36 years.
The bakery started because it was a dream of my dad's. He was a pastry chef back in the Netherlands, and they immigrated to Canada and then eventually worked their way up to Fairbanks, came into Anchorage right before the 64 earthquake, and stayed because Wally Hickle was going to build a hotel. And my dad said, if Mr. Hickle's going to build a hotel, I'm going to stay here as well and start my life. The year that they started the shop was also the year he got his private pilot's license. So the name The Flying Dutchman was a play on that, along with the history of the lost ship and the story behind that. So The Flying Dutchman was kind of a twofold of history. And that's how it started back in 1982. You know, the Europeans, the borders are all much more open. The countries are so small, everybody crossed borders. The traditions go from generation to generation. So again, we have people come in asking, you know, for just a Dutch pastry or just a Swedish pastry. What we have found the best answer is if it has almond and if it has butter, it's European. Those are kind of the requirements. In cakes, butter and whipped cream. Not too sweet. That's a big thing, not too sweet. The tarts are probably our biggest seller as far as people coming in. They're a nice variety, different flavors, you know, almonds, fruits, nuts. So it's a nice way to get a variety of flavors and get the almond and the butter. This time of year is the quieter time for us. Everyone has their New Year's resolutions. They're all going to lose weight. We usually find it lasts a couple of weeks and then people start coming in again. But we've been still very fortunate. People keep coming and finding us, and every time we're grateful for that. I have so many people that tell me, oh, I love to bake. I love to bake. I want to have your job. And I say to them, if you love to bake, don't open a pastry shop. Because it's not about baking, it's about paying the bills, it's about making the responsibilities, it's about getting up. I love my horses, so I don't do horses for a living, because I can go home and enjoy my horses and my dogs.
Frida Koper lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Vikram Patel. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Tim Ellis and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.